Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it is September 15th, 2016, my birthday, so that it does have that going for it. And that's really irrelevant. Listen, as we scan the world's predicaments with equal measures of dread and hope, people often ask me, why aren't people doing something? Meaning usually, why aren't people standing up and saying no? Why isn't anybody protesting? Well, the sad truth is that often people are, and you're just not hearing about it. When the Iraq war protests erupted, the largest anti-war protests in world history happened, when over a million U.S. people showed up at the largest peacetime protest in its history. The New York Times saw fit to print the news on page A16, little tiny column, saying only that, quote, tens of thousands of anti-war protesters marched in several demonstrations around the country today, end quote. Really? Tens of thousands, huh? Of course, the New York Times had deep conflicts of interest and promoted that war every step of the way, including publishing falsified intelligence from unnamed U.S. officials. When the Occupy Wall Street protests came along, they were ignored and then denigrated by the mainstream press. So if you have the impression that people are not protesting, not standing up, not finally saying no more, it may be because it simply hasn't been reported on. Today, there's another protest going on that has become a movement, and I want to be sure you know about it. Now, back in April of 2016, a few Standing Rock tribal members set up a camp in a small valley next to the Cannonball River protesting the so-called Dakota Access Pipeline, designed to carry oil 1,200 miles from the Bakken oil fields, which we report on all the time, to a distribution center in Illinois. That protest caught fire, and that camp by the river is now larger than most small towns in North Dakota. Something big is happening, and it's much bigger than a protest to block something. It's about finally standing for something that needed to be done. It's about standing for something. To discuss this with us today is a really good friend of mine, Mark Morey. Now, Mark is a creative artist, a visionary educator, cultural engineer, and consultant who designs regenerative, holistic communities with timeless native principles. But really, it's very hard to capture the brilliant and cutting-edge work that is Mark's mission in the world. Let's let that unfold a little bit for you in this podcast. So, welcome, Mark.
Thanks, Chris. Happy birthday.
Well, thanks. Listen, I really didn't know how to introduce you properly, because your work in the world, it really is, it's so deep and complex. So, in your own words, who are you and what do you do?
Well, you know, I think artist has been something that I've worked with for a while, because at some point I went off trail from the normal path of growing up in the 70s and, you know, going to college and getting a job and that whole career path. Certain things along the way, I think, disrupted that dream. And maybe one of them was growing up in the nuclear age. Mm-hmm. And the nuclear escalation between the USSR and the United States was something that created a hypervigilance for me, that right around the age of 13, 14 years old, I realized, wow, we could be totally annihilated here as part of my childhood. And other things after that. Essentially, I basically wanted to work with my life and say, what could I do to make the biggest difference for the most amount of people that would last the longest amount of time? And that's been a driving set of questions that has led me to the term regenerative, for example. How can I leave it better than I found it? It's driven me to look at the core principles of what it means to be a human being. Mm-hmm. And look at the context of our history and step out of the bubble of thinking this is status quo and just seeing some of the major trends that have happened. And although I grew up in the suburbs and watched the construction of entire neighborhoods and places I used to play, you know, and then I could only use sidewalks that led to the mall after that, I realized that human beings, for most of humanity, were deeply connected to the natural world with direct relationships to their sustenance and their well-being. And As we've drifted from that, there's been a big pattern of losing our relationship with the very thing that sustains us. So for me, on a very systemic level, if we're going to create a more habitable world for future generations, that is at the core, is returning our culture and our children and our processes into returning them to deep relationship with nature as a fundamental part of being human.
Well, great description. And it starts to speak to what I alluded to, which is about this Standing Rock protest being for something. And so let's turn to that now, because we could have a really deep conversation about everything you just mentioned, and I hope we do. But for now, help paint the picture of the Standing Rock movement, how to get started, and what's going on there now.
Well, you know, like everything, you can just say, let's look at the triggers and incidents of this very moment. But it's also, at the same time, we should look at how we got here. Flashpoints for large events are hard to track sometimes. You know, how did Occupy Wall Street and all the other protests that came out of that happen? And another one would be Idle No More, which came out of Canada, an individual who decided to stand and say, you know, as a Native person, we exist, and we've been marginalized for so long, we're not going to take it anymore. And then also Black Lives Matter, another one that all of a sudden, it's like the trend's been going on for a long time. It's not like there weren't bad things happening 50 years ago or 100 years ago, but there are these flashpoints happening. So I think we're in an era of self-organizing, emergent social revolutions. I don't know what to call them. Even the Bernie Sanders campaign had qualities of that.
Mm-hmm.
Unexpectedly, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, 50,000 people coming together for a candidate during a Democratic primary was just unheard of, you know, crashing all records. So this is another one of those in my mind. And this particular one was started by teenagers and youth, believe it or not. In April, when you do the research, they stood up and they were the first ones to put their campsite down in that very location in Cannonball, because they had this very deep and real sense of their future being threatened. And I saw one of the teenagers, they went all the way to D.C. to speak with Bernie Sanders and whoever else is there, Bill McKibben, yesterday or the day before. And there she is. She's 16 years old. And she says, you know, I grew up on a reservation in the middle of this great place where my ancestors have been living here forever. You know, there's a kind of authority that comes from that lineage. And they say, clean water, you know, is our heritage and our right and what we're standing for forever and the way we do things. So, you know, she starts to cry and thinking, the oil corporations don't care about my children, you know. The pipeline was going to run north of Bismarck, North Dakota, up there in the watershed, but they deemed it too dangerous for those residents, so they ran it down by the reservation.
Too dangerous for the people of Bismarck, but not too dangerous for the people who lived out a little further south who happened to be Native Americans.
Exactly, and that's a pattern, right? Social justice and environmental damage are often correlated,
mm-hmm.
because they're at the margins and there's no media there, and you can ship uranium to, you know, the Navajo or whatever's going on. And what's unusual is standing up against literally the machine, the bulldozer, or standing up against the billion-dollar oil energy companies, and they are the poorest people in our country. They are third world poverty, you know, 70% poverty people, with their causes of death being things like alcoholism and suicide and diabetes, not the kinds of things we see as the leading causes of death from depression and oppression. To see them stand up, I think, ultimately had this mythic quality to it of the ultimate, you know, weakest, smallest, poorest person with the greatest spirit and most righteous stance that you can't drink oil, you know. That once this thing is polluted, 16 million people downstream are affected. And it just magnetized not only people to come help them, but all of these tribes in the U.S. sent representatives there. There's over 250 representative tribes there, which has never happened before in the history of the U.S. And they are putting up flags of their nations, and there's this long corridor of nations sovereign nations, native people's flags. And so when they come in, there's this incredible sense of an indigenous resurrection and power to the message they have for the modern world. And of course, it's in the context of climate change, right? All the stuff that's coming out around the end of nature as we know it, perhaps the Anthropocene and the end of how we understand our world because we've so affected it. Perhaps these people have something to offer us, right? And so also non-Native people are going there and offering resources and help around the country. And there's something like 7,000 people camping there now.
That's amazing. And I'm noting here that it's a really complex history. You know, you've touched on part of it, which says we tend to root environmentally hazardous things near the people who can put up the least amount of fuss. And it's not an illegitimate claim to say we're worried about our water. There was the Kalamazoo pipeline spill, which just deeply trashed a whole bunch of the Kalamazoo River when a very tarry substance came boiling out of that pipeline. Pipelines burst. It happens all the time. So this is a realistic concern. And the history here, I think, is important. You know, the land beneath the pipeline, that was accorded to the Sioux people by the Treaty of Fort Laramie in 1868. So they have the treaty. Mm-hmm. 11 years later, the U.S. government incited the so-called Great Sioux War, but then renegotiated, air quotes, renegotiated that new treaty with the Sioux under the threat of starvation. And so there's a very long and complex history of treaties being written and broken. And every time the white man, to use that term, wanted something, oh, there's gold in the Black Hills. Oh, wait, we like to farm in this land. They would just, air quotes, renegotiate the treaties, meaning break them and write them again. So there's got to be a sense there that among the people that whatever the U.S. courts, I know there's a whole court battle around this Dakota Access Pipeline, but that whatever the courts decide is really only as binding as until somebody decides to break it on the other side. There's not a really good history of trust here, is there?
Right. I think they keep track of these things, and I saw the number 560 treaties broken. And it's an enormous legal history when you think about if everything were the same, if Native people had the same level of power and representation as the modern world, you know, everyone would be in jail. You know, there'd be so many reparations, the entire country would go bankrupt.
Yeah. Yeah, so you've been there, right?
Of course, you know. Oh, no, Standing Rock? No, yeah. I just booked tickets yesterday to go out there. I've been supporting a network of people that I've been working with for the last 20 years, which I would call Nature Connection mentors in communities, people who want to raise their children from zero to appreciate and honor the natural world with actual naturalist knowledge of place. And the origin of a lot of the Nature Connection movement, you know, Richard Louv is a big spokesperson, mm-hmm. who wrote a book called Last Child in the Woods, who's concerned about a lot of modern maladies that children have today are directly related to the fact that they don't go outside anymore, mm-hmm. and they don't understand that their body is a natural thing and they don't move it, and so they have obesity and there's too much screen time and all this kind of stuff. So that's something to look into. But there's a huge movement out there who have been sourced by indigenous wisdom, you know, and very directly so. People I've known, like Gilbert Walking Bull, came from South Dakota and spent years and years and years mentoring and sharing Native knowledge with us, often because he was looking for any kind of allies as bank against the future. And so we are, you know, in direct, you know, lineage of this man, right, who has contributed so much of his life. He's a direct descendant of Sitting Bull on one side and Crazy Horse on the other, and even Red Cloud. So there's a lot of grace that these Nature Connection communities have been supported, and I think there's a natural reciprocity that is emerging right now. So they all want to do something. So I've been coordinating van loads of food and firewood and teepees and you know, gas cards or whatever they need to make it through their experience there, to make it through the winter.
Now, how have you been raising funds for that?
I started a crowdfunding campaign. I researched real quickly, like, what was the best that most had the right framing for it. So it wasn't like Kickstarter. I found one called You Caring, which is a compassionate crowdfunding. Like if your neighbor has cancer or someone's house gets flooded, you know, I thought, you know, the indigenous people are our neighbors, right, who are having a hard time. Let's rally and support them. So we raised $5,000 in about a week through that. And then I sent money in hand with a friend, mutual friend named Tim, who ended up there to go on a media journey to help, you know, tell the story because it's not being publicized. And he, with some other friends of mine, met people on the ground, said, what do you need? And just went and got it for them. So there was really direct contribution to whatever people needed there. And often it was firewood, you know, medical supplies, shoes, warm clothing, mauls and axes, a chainsaw, shelters, things like that.
Mm. Now, I want to sort of harp on something that I spoke to in the intro, which is I'm looking right now at the front pages of the Wall Street Journal, New York Times. Today, here on my screen, not one article about this, not one. So you just described this as the largest gathering in all of history of sovereign nations of Native Americans coming together. So that seems like fairly big news, but it's not on the front page. And when I did a Google search using the term Standing Rock, and I constrained it to the last 24 hours, I didn't see one article in a major outlet listed on the front page. You know, HuffPo, sure, Grist, Yes Magazine, that sort. No mainstream coverage. Do you know, are there any mainstream outlets there, and are they covering this?
Well, I saw one article on the cover of the New York Times.
So far. I didn't see it recently, so that must have come out a while ago. But
It was last week.
Last week. Great. So, old news.
And that was impressive. I didn't think I would see that. It was very impressive, and it wasn't a terribly biased story, but there have been plenty of biased stories coming out because North Dakota is not a wealthy state as far as I know, and I think a lot of the political policies follow that economic trouble. Like, you know, as the economy declines, so does rights and freedoms.
Mm-hmm.
And the governor is pulling a couple of moves that are questionable, including negative media slandering. You know, they bring violent dogs to bite and attack. They would call themselves protectors. They're not even actually doing anything violent. And then they put in the media, you know, protesters turned violent.
Uh-huh.
But they're the one that sent these security forces in with these awful attack dogs. I mean, it was like a humanitarian crisis.
Yeah, and these were, this is a private firm that got hired in. I think G4S was involved, maybe some others. But these are private so-called security firms. And these firms have been associated with some really awful stuff around the world that's been done under their name and for pay. So they've brought in really top-line mercenaries to go up against these people. It's not even like they hired in a few extra off-duty state policemen. They brought in what I consider to be the most hardened mercenary firm we actually have available to us right now.
Yeah, it's definitely dark, and it seems that the mindset is that we're going to get away with this. We just need to crush this. And I think that media actually worked against them, which is one of the benefits of the internet and technology today. Some people feel conflicted about using gas generators at this water protector camp against oil pipelines, or using media when you're a native person. But when you consider the complex world we're in, it's the very thing that is bringing attention to a marginalized people. Like prior to that, it was whoever controlled the media controlled the story. So when those images came out around the dogs and the pepper spray, I mean, you have to picture these people are standing there with no weapons, with their arms in the air, saying, we're not going to let you bulldoze this land. This is actually sacred site, not just water protection here. And the mercenary type people with their dogs, which are like frothing in the mouth and barking and biting, they just took the mace and went down the line of people and sprayed it in their face.
Mm-hmm.
It was just that blatant. And they filmed the whole thing, and that media went viral. And that caused thousands of more people to sign on and send money to the legal campaign. I think they raised over $1 million at the Standing Stone Legal Fund, crowdfunder. So they have financial support to just keep taking this to court and keep representing all those broken treaties, as well as their current ecological concerns and as well as their cultural concerns about the destruction going on. There's so many areas that this legal direction can take place, but I think the biggest part is in establishing a new worldview that this isn't going away,
mm-hmm.
and that even more so, the voice of the indigenous actually, in my opinion and belief, is the very thing that's going to get us out of the systemic issues that we're in, not pushing oil and dirty oil even harder after there's 300 oil spills a year from pipelines. Like, why don't we just stop that given the climate crisis, given the Anthropocene? There's every good reason to do so. So we're going to have to fight a little bit more than just discuss. And they're saying, we're going to put our bodies on the line. We have nothing left to lose.
Hmm.
And that's inspiring.
Now let's talk about that larger movement here then, because really you talked about all these nucleation points where things are bubbling up. But basically, if I could put them under an umbrella, it's look, status quo is now no longer not just advantageous for us, but it's actually harming us. And whether we're looking at that through the Anthropocene lens and what's happening with global climate change, we're looking at the great wealth divide as the Federal Reserve prints more and more money, but it magically only happens to enrich a very, very tiny elite, or whether we're looking at the degree to which the United States police forces have been militarized and have adopted those military tactics to bring home, not to protect and to serve, but to treat people as combatants who need to be neutralized. I mean, I've seen the militarization language go on. There was a policeman who was just fired because he refused to shoot a man who had a gun in his hand who was saying, shoot me, shoot me. He preferred to try and talk him down. His force fired him because he didn't neutralize a threat, is how they put it. That's just, or eliminate a threat, one of those two. And it's just...
Right.
Right. So a lot of people are coming together and saying, nah, this doesn't work. And they are younger people increasingly. And I love to hear that this started with some young people, and you work directly with young people. And so I'd like to ask about, I'm asking a hopeful question. I want to hear that something's starting and that people have said enough. Right. So if you can't help me out with that, try anyway.
And the question is,
what do you see? Is this really something, part of something larger, or is this just, you know, another protest that's, you know, going to just sort of flare and burn?
Yeah, I've asked myself that 100 times in the last week, and I like to not be kind of swept up by just heated emotion.
Mm-hmm.
I like to really consider what's happening. And, you know, I'm 50 now, and I've seen a lot of things in the last 30 years. And I think this is a decided turning point when it comes to the intersection between climate change, indigenous wisdom, and activism across the board. Because even Bill McKibben, who part of 350.org, he said he's written tons and tons of books and been advisors to presidencies, and he's part of huge coalitions. He assisted Bernie Sanders in his campaign. That he said, we're no longer in a dialogue. You know, I thought we were having an argument, meaning like a scientific discussion and discourse on policy and where to go. And all the data is out, you know, since the 90s. And, you know, actually it's been out longer than that, but they just hit it. That he says, well, no, we're actually no longer in a discussion, because it actually takes two people to have an argument. We're actually in a fight, because that's just not going to stop. So he actually redirected his entire movement to basically say, go put your bodies in the line and keep the carbon in the ground. That's where we're at. We have 5 years. We can't talk for 5 years. So that he redirected tens of thousands of people to actually go stop the Australian port from shipping coal and many other places. So that there's an emergent thing happening in more areas than just this one. There are youth right now. There's a group of 17 youth who are suing the federal government based on negligence, that they are not providing a habitable future for them. Hmm. And they're in the Oregon courts right now. I believe they'll probably go all the way to the federal courts over this. So that's something that's never happened before. Children suing the federal government. I mean, just the whole community image of children going to their parents saying, you've been negligent for my future. You should be responsible for this conversation, but I have to stand up. There's something completely poetic and moving and sad and inspiring all at the same time. That kind of thing is just never happened before. And when the children bring their youthful spirit and action together, I think maybe shame is too strong a word, but it has this kind of connotation of like, oh, I'm embarrassed at my unconscious behavior. I've been stuck in status quo. I haven't really questioned things, and they're right.
Well, maybe
across the board.
If it's, you know, shame might arise, but really that's a personal decision as to whether you go to shame. I think the children are saying you've been acting out of integrity. And that can be a shameful moment when you realize that's true, right? But they're saying you've been saying this and doing that. So it's about the actions. And I agree with Bill McKibben. It's a fight. My framing on this is that this isn't about the information. It's never been about the information. It's
right.
Always been about the fact that we have belief systems that are entrenched. And there's a status quo defense belief system out there that can't let go of the idea that we're clever monkeys who are entitled to grow infinitely forever, exponentially, and we're never going to have to take a look at that behavior set because we don't want to. And kids who grew up differently are saying, well, wait a minute, I'm not as wedded to that belief system you happen to have. Never worked for me anyway. That whole American dream thing, keep telling yourself that. We know better. Doesn't exist. So they're starting to step up and say, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense. And it's not a conversation. You can't have a conversation with a belief system. It's just is wackadoodle. So there has to be something more than saying, I'm going to continue to engage in dialogue with you. Protesting is one way. But there's sort of a resignation that can happen as well. A checking out, a saying, I'm just not participating. I'm not going to engage with your system here.
Right. Like, what's the alternative?
What is the alternative?
Well, I think there's the door that is always an option that's sitting there that can go into denial is, well, you know, it's just a little easier if I stay in the current system and maximize it a little bit more. I might even be aware of options, but I'm just going to stay here a little bit longer, a little bit more, even though I know it's heading towards a brick wall. I read the articles every day. You know, but I still go to work because that's my job and I got to stay in the system. And I think there's a lot of, what would you call that, inertia that mm-hmm. keeps people in the same spot. Whereas, you know, if you practice going off trail, you know, taking risks, maybe departing the secure job or downsizing your family to a smaller economic and ecological footprint, it gives you more freedom to actually act in alignment with your human values. The spiritual capital that you get in replacement of the financial capital actually makes life meaningful. So what kind of adult do you want to be in the world? What kind of surplus of vision and meaningfulness do you want to leave are based on those choices. So for me, you know, I've spent a lot of my life organizing outside the system and seeing it pay off in moments like this, almost like it's been dormant, you know, or slowly percolating for a long time, where there's tens of thousands of people who are in positions of privilege, right? Positions of economic advantage because they're not native, right? And they can turn to this situation and all act in concert and send millions of dollars or tens of thousands of dollars or hundreds of vehicles to that place and stand there with them. And it's no longer a bad native people issue. This is a cross-the-board human issue, cross colors, cross tribes. So I think this is the beginning of all sorts of energy project issues that are going to happen more and more and more, and we'll look back on it and say that was a landmark turning point where the people stood up.
I like this idea of the elevation of the human issues because it's impossible to open the newspaper and not discover a disgusting anti-human issue that sort of pops up and is just sort of accepted. Like when I read that in a state where there is a marijuana legalization effort, that one of the chief contributors to the anti side of that equation. So the people who are pouring the most money into preventing marijuana legalization are companies that manufacture opioid substances, right?
Unbelievable.
You know, the ones particularly who are doing the sublingual fentanyl or the company that makes OxyContin, they pour hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars to block medical marijuana or recreational marijuana from coming in because the data shows their businesses suffer. And the data also shows that these companies are responsible for many thousands of deaths from overdoses and addiction things that destroy lives. And this is just reported in our news like, oh, isn't that curious? No, it's not curious. It's anti-human. I mean, how far off the reservation, so to use that term, how far off of reality do we have to be where we go, oh, this makes sense for companies who are knowingly engaged in a product set that is anti-human life, that they can try and block something that's extremely safe and natural, and we're okay with that on some level. Like, this just, it's just bizarre. So to me, that's, there's like so much fuel here, which is, I think, you know, what I'm trying to tease out that's happening here is people are rising up and saying, stop already. Just, yep. Just stop. And what do you do when you're up against an insane adversary, right? Do you try and match their insanity or do you do something completely different? It's an open question. Right. Like, is this protest the right way? I don't know, but I'm encouraged that people are doing whatever they can in this
right.
moment.
Right, I'm with you. There's an aspect of what's different. And so here's an example of what's different, as odd as this might sound to maybe some of the listeners. So this encampment, there's actually a couple of them there in Cannonball. The daily practice that's happening, this is organized by Native people, and this is their house. So when you go to visit there, this is the way they do things, right? That there are ceremonies all day long and all night long that are healing ceremonies, that are prayerful ceremonies using a sweat lodge or their sacred pipe or other methods of calling in spiritual support and asking for what's the best way for us to proceed. That is charging their environment every single day to where the chief, you know, the chairman of the Standing Rock tribe makes these announcements through the elders saying, the spirits have told us that as long as we are nonviolent, we're going to win this. They're completely clear about that. So this isn't like an antagonistic fight fire with fire situation. This is like a sourced from the earth, from their ancestral traditions, their empowered peoples, to do this in a Gandhian way. So I think something completely new is happening here, and it's just off the radar. People don't understand it. They think they can get rid of it. It's only going to grow stronger because it's righteous in the literal sense.
Hmm. I love hearing how that's new. So, listen, I think people should find out more about this and be following this in something other than just through the headlines and the articles that are out there, because there's something a lot deeper happening here. And how would people follow this if you could give them advice?
Well, I've just done a little bit of research myself, and I've come across a number of people who are reporting directly from the camps who are Native, and they have little media outfits there, and they're going around and interviewing people, and it's the cleanest, direct sense of what's happening there at any given time. You can always get the real story when you tune into their, let's say, live Facebook feeds. I'm posting lots of things through a page I created called the Red Cloud Defense Center, and it organizes, you know, those live media feeds, and it also organizes people who want to send things and don't know what to do or where to go.
Is that a Facebook page?
The Red Cloud Defense Center is what we called it.
Yeah, that's a Facebook page?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we also, there's a guy named Myron Dewey, does really great live posts about what's going on there. And the Standing Rock Reservation, their main camp, I think, is called Sacred Stones Camp.org. And so there's a FAQ there and information that you can check in with. So those are some of the ways, and you can also find lots of Native media outlets that are coming out of there. But those are the ones that I've been using.
Fantastic. So here's the thing. You know, the people listening to this who would like to help, I think that you've got a really direct feed for helping. And of course, there'd be other ones they might be able to source as well. But what's your crowdfunding page?
It's under youcaring.com, and it's called Immediate Resources for Standing Rock Water Protection Camps, because they've redefined the language as not protesters. They said we're not protesting anything. We're simply protecting what is.
Mm.
So it's Immediate Resources for Standing Rock Water Protection Camps.
Fantastic. And well, so, we'll provide a link to that as
great.
Well below this podcast, because I think people should have the easy opportunity to contribute to that. And I want to just point out that to contribute to that is to contribute to something it's more of a movement, and it's not a protest, it's a protection, and that this is direct action. And so if you are thinking, why isn't anybody doing anything? Well, they are, and this is
they
what
are.
It's going to have to look like. And people, yeah. warriors like Bill McKibben, who spent, I don't know how many years and how much of his life batting his head against a brick wall, you know, thinking that somehow that brick wall was listening. It's not. Beliefs don't change with information. They have to be confronted. And sometimes it looks like an intervention and it's not pretty.
Mm-hmm.
So really,
exactly.
in some ways, I think what Standing Rock is about, it's an intervention. It's saying, stop, modern people. You have some other things you need to consider and think about here. And that it's really an opportunity to sit back and take stock of where we are. And boy, that has to happen.
Yeah. It's inspiring also to, engage with the indigenous conversation, because it does shift your worldview too, which is a very personal action that you can take, is to seek to understand, and share the story. So that's one of the things that happens when you go there is you could go in there as a white man who represents everything we're talking about, and a native elder will walk up to you, and this is a story I heard over and over again. They'll shake your hand without even knowing you and say, welcome. Thank you so much for coming here. I don't know what drew you to come, but you are totally welcome. Thank you. And they give you a gift.
Hmm. Wow.
Just like that.
Yeah. So here's the thing. If you're thinking about giving to this, please do. This is a really incredibly worthy cause. I hope it has great legs to go beyond even this one pipeline issue. I'm really, this is the kind of thing that I think we've all been waiting for. It's like, well, when's something going to happen? Well, it's happening. It's not really being reported on all that much. Now, if somebody does give, how could they be connected to what happens with that gift? How will they know it got there? Or are you harvesting any stories about how people use the money? You know, we had the best campfire ever because of the wood that came from this money. Or how are you connecting those dots, if you are?
On the You Caring page, I'm posting fundraiser updates mm-hmm. of the people who've gone out there, the things that they're contributing, the names of the people we're meeting, and the personal stories. And I'm also just putting links to, videos on the Red Cloud page that I mentioned. So there's lots of intimate ways to feel connected to this. And that's one of the benefits of, you know, collectively putting our resources together for, is we feel like I could send $25 and not know what happens. But if I'm part of $10,000, I know we bought a winterized four-season wall tent with wood stove for the security team who are there to create peace within this camp. And here's the name of that guy, here's his photograph, and here's the teaching he gave us about this, you know. So it's very immediate and very fulfilling.
Well, I really think this is very much worth supporting, and my wife Beck and I, we just had a podcast where we talked about some of the lessons harvested from Art of Mentoring. People may be familiar with that if they've heard that podcast. But really, I mean, one of the pieces was around how do we support people? Obviously, there's financial support is important. That lets people know you're supporting them. There's lots of other ways to support people who are trying the new things that need to be done. Because can we just be honest here? The status quo, not only can it not be preserved, but it really shouldn't be in lots of ways. There are things we need to be doing differently. Always difficult to know what those things are. But we should support whatever we can see coming along, and not all of them will work. But hey, you know what? That's part of being an entrepreneur in essence. You know, we have to try stuff and we're going to put it out there and we'll see what works, because the old way isn't working anymore. You know, in particular, if we think it's going to end in the destruction of massive ecosystems, which it already is on its way to doing, that's a sign maybe it isn't working, you know? So let's get creative and try something. So this is more to me than some native people trying to block a single pipeline. It's really what's under that needs to be talked about, because it's not about this pipeline. It's about this human experiment and asking the questions that the status quo, the mainstream media is a representative of, doesn't seem to be interested in asking, but young people are, and curious people are, and people who have woken up from the dream have started to ask these questions. I think that's what's really kind of, you know, going along here. And of course, you'd have to, you kind of have to dig around to find it, but these things are happening. It's getting hard to suppress them.
That's right. Very good. And, you know, one of the things, even if you want to think strategically about this, if we want to create health and wellness and be resilient, valuing diversity is a good strategy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the marginalized people at the edge actually have a completely different worldview that can help us solve a lot of problems that we're not thinking of ourselves. That alone is a good thing to lean into and say, how can I explore that difference? How do they see the world? What if we brought them to the table and made them a partner in making decisions for the future generations? What would they say? That would be a good investment.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Well, with that, Mark Morey, thank you so much for your time. Your website, please, so people can find out more about you.
Thank you. www.aconnectedleader.com.
aconnectedleader, all one word, .com?
Correct.
All right. And listen, I hope to have you back on, because I want to talk about some just fantastic articles that have been coming out lately that we've been exploring about how kids learn or don't learn, and all of that. And of course, you're one of the seminal people who really influenced my children and my thinking on education and how all that works. And so there's just so much to harvest from you. But thank you for your time today on the Standing Rock issue.
Thank you very much, Chris, and happy birthday.
Thank you. It's a two-hand kind of a thing these days, you know. Once you're over 50, like, well, yeah, happy birthday, but another one. So there it is.
All right.
All right.
Have a good day.
You too.